This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. If abortion rights are overturned at the Supreme Court, what is next? LGBTQI advocates worry about the overturning of same-sex marriage and the criminalization of gender-affirming procedures for transgender kids. Indeed, Republican-led states have already begun small-scale assaults, chipping away bit by bit at the rights that we've taken for granted, just as they did with the right to an abortion. My guest is Chrissy Stroop, ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, co-editor with Lauren O'Neill of the essay anthology Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. She's also a senior correspondent for Religion Dispatches, and her work has appeared in Dame Magazine, Foreign Policy, the Boston Globe, Playboy, Political Research Associates, and other outlets, including peer-reviewed academic journals. Welcome to the program, Chrissy.
Thank you, Sonali.
So there are many different groups that sort of came together to make possible the eventual overturning of Roe versus Wade at the Supreme Court. You have the Christian right foot soldiers on the ground, the ones who, you know, vote who are single issue voters. Then you have the state lawmakers who, try to get their votes at all costs. And then, of course, you have the conservative justices on the Supreme Court. So when it comes to LGBTQI rights, are the foot soldiers the same? Is there a sort of direct overlap, or at least some intersection, between the anti-abortionists and the homophobes?
There certainly is. For the most part, they are the same people. And it all comes back to patriarchy, and within the United States, to white supremacist patriarchy, even though they usually won't say the racist parts out loud anymore. An Indiana senator the other day did actually say that he thinks the Supreme Court should overturn Loving versus Virginia. He then walked it back a little bit, but
that was the case that basically made it, that overturned anti-miscegenation laws, right? That allowed people of different races to marry.
That is correct. Before that time, it was state by state whether interracial marriage was allowed. And so Loving v. Virginia was the Supreme Court case that legalized interracial marriage nationwide. Why Mike Braun, at least the reasoning that he gave for that, is that he really consistently believes that states should have the rights to set their own laws for marriage and that sort of thing. He, of course, can't say that he doesn't actually want, you know, white people and black people to marry each other, although I certainly would suspect that, you know, he does. But even just saying Loving v. Virginia should be overturned was kind of giving away the game. And he had to walk it back a little bit. But certainly right now, they do see attacks on the LGBTQ community and the trans community in particular as a powerful culture wars wedge issue. And there are discussions among Republican senators and congressional representatives about the possibility of overturning Obergefell, you know, the Supreme Court decision that in 2015 legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. I do expect we will see a challenge to that, very possibly coming from Texas. A lot of the worst laws will most likely come out of Texas and make their way up to the Supreme Court because, of course, Texas is a party to the Fifth Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. And so either via the Texas Supreme Court or the Fifth Circuit, you can make it to the Supreme Court. And that is conservatives' favorite federal circuit to use because it tends to rule in their favor, whereas, of course, progressives and liberals like to get cases taken up by the Ninth Circuit, which tends to rule in favor of progressives.
I mean, it just seems so hard to imagine that same-sex marriage could be overturned, even though, of course, it is a much newer right than the right to an abortion. The Roe versus Wade decision went all the way back to 1973, but the anti-abortionists played the long game, and I suppose you have to admire their tenacity and the bit by bit victories that they won at the state level that, of course, was also part and parcel of the Trump presidency, right? I mean, this white supremacist president was, you know, his values seemed antithetical to evangelical ideals, but he promised to appoint anti-abortion Supreme Court justices, and he delivered on three of them. So they seemed to have no problem throwing their own values under the bus when certain issues are at stake.
I mean, it depends on how you look at their values and how they rationalize them. So I think their ultimate values have always been domination, control. They're afraid of the other. And I mean, the reason that it all goes back to patriarchy is, you know, of course, legal abortion destabilizes patriarchal control by empowering women, but also the very existence of queer people, particularly if queer people are visible and thriving, destabilizes patriarchy. So it's something that they fear. They want to bring the whole country into conformity with their values. I grew up in this environment, you know, raised to be a culture warrior, attending evangelical Christian schools that are quite extremist. We said three pledges every day to the American flag, the Christian flag, and the Bible in that order. And we were basically taught that the nation would be blessed if we if the nation was obedient to God. So that meant that abortion should be illegal, that there should be no rights for queer people. I didn't have much language or concept of what the whole queer spectrum was, and that's partly why I wasn't even able to recognize that I myself am queer until I was in my 30s. They really want to erase the whole thing, and you can also see the connections there, including the connections to race. If you look at Florida's passage of the Don't Say Gay law, and as well as the Republican attempts to ban the supposed teaching of critical race theory in schools. But also, if you just look at some of the sort of PR photo ops, the pictures that were put out of Republican governors signing these illiberal laws, look at the picture of Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, you know, signing the Don't Say Gay law. He's surrounded by little white children, most of them girls. And this whole issue of purity culture in evangelical subculture, which some people, you know, some viewers may associate with purity rings, purity balls, purity pledges. I was basically coerced and cajoled into signing a purity pledge in seventh grade, by the way. The 90s was the height of that sort of thing, but it's still going on. But the roots of that are in this fear of, as you say, quote unquote, miscegenation, right? And we talked about Loving v. Virginia, the anti-miscegenation laws being overturned by that Supreme Court case. Why does Roe tie all this together in particular? Roe is kind of the holy grail for this right to privacy, which is a part of what legal scholars call incorporation doctrine, the way that rights can be integrated nationwide through the 14th Amendment, which you know, declared that all residents of states are citizens of the states in which they reside and of the United States. And so in theory, you have to give them equal protection. Roe rested in part on that, in part on this idea of there's a right to privacy that was established through Griswold v. Connecticut, which legalized access to birth control as a private matter, you know, between families and doctors and individuals and their doctors and so forth. And Republicans are already gearing up to overturn Griswold as well. So we'll see some cases like that coming up through the courts, I suspect. Idaho, some Idaho Republicans are currently looking to pass a bill to overturn, to ban the IUDs, you know, intrauterine devices, as a form of birth control. Some Missouri Republicans are actually talking about banning condoms, as absurd as that seems. And this is where we are in America today. And so you pass a law like that, presumably, even though the federal courts have been, you know, stacked with right-wing extremists, obviously including the Supreme Court, in ways that I consider to be illegitimate by these radical right-wingers playing the long game. I still suspect that initially these laws will be enjoined, but they can make their way up to the Supreme Court in this case, and the Supreme Court will very likely overturn all kinds of precedents. including Griswold. So
I mean, it's basically amazing
because this is the way that you eviscerate the right to privacy, and you eviscerate all kinds of rights that have been located in the 14th Amendment.
It seems remarkable that the Democrats have not responded to this with the kind of fervor that we ought to expect, just the overturning of the abortion right. You know, many critics have said there's no other sort of clearer sign since Trump's election that this is a move toward fascism. I mean, if you don't have autonomy over your own body, what else do you have? And of course, the patriarchy part plays into it in a big way, because if it was really about saving children, then there would be equal fervor to insist that, you know, men get vasectomies that are reversible, you know, as soon as boys become of a certain age, you know, you could certainly see the idea of vasectomies that could be reversed when they're ready to have children. But of course, it's never about, and of course, I would never advocate such a thing. I'm the mother of two boys. But this is in line with the patriarchal misogynist approach that the evangelical right adopts. And one of the things that you point out, Chrissy, in your article that you had written for Open Democracy, It's True Crisis Time for Trans People in America, I want to pick up on this important through line, which is that saving children is an overarching rallying cry. This is what they say on the surface, to mm-hmm. obscure, and that's the sort of facade to obscure the misogynist, patriarchal, white supremacist themes, right? Saving children. But of course, it's not as though the Christian right really does support pro-children policies, right?
Not at all. Yeah, saving children works very powerfully rhetorically. They've been doing it for a very long time. It was used as a part of, you know, Anita Bryant's homophobic campaign back in the 1970s. It was part and parcel of the satanic panic of the 1980s. And here's an interesting thing about the 1970s and the 1980s. This is when our society really begins to confront the issue of child abuse, and child abuse being a relatively widespread thing. If you look back even to the 40s, you know, doctors are starting to figure out from certain injuries that some children beat their parents severely and injure them, or sorry, the other way around, some parents beat their children severely and cause them severe injuries. And this was going around mainly sort of academic circles, but it's not until the 60s and 70s that society really starts to confront this, and then also the issue of sexual abuse of children. So this is all coming out into the public discourse at the same time, of course, as second wave feminism is rising and the move for bodily autonomy is rising. And as part of the response to that, these right-wing, mostly white communities in which both physical and sexual abuse of children is a serious issue start projecting outward. And if you actually look at the abusive dynamics that have come to light within, for example, evangelical churches, predominantly white evangelical churches, the tendency usually is to blame the victim and protect the abuser, particularly if he's a powerful man, like a youth pastor or a head pastor of a church, some kind of leader. Cover-ups and abuse are endemic to this subculture. And, you know, that, of course, has deep roots, but deeper than just the 1970s as well. But, you know, in the 1970s, they start using this language of grooming, and, oh, gay people have to recruit, and they're all pedophiles. In the 1980s, that becomes, you know, sort of morphs into these widespread fears of supposed satanic ritual abuse. But this is an externalization of a problem that is actually very widespread in these communities, which are authoritarian, very patriarchal. And because they are so patriarchal, you know, the conditions are very ripe for abuse to happen within these communities. And we know that it does happen pretty frequently.
And you point out that just the whole sort of projection aspect works for today's obsession by the QAnon cultish groups, right, who seem mm-hmm. to overlook all of this, you know, pedophilia happening within the Republican ranks and then make up wild conspiracy theories about Democrats or liberals.
Right. I think that, you know, fundamentalism and often fundamentalism is a kind of authoritarianism. And I think also just authoritarian personalities, they often come from a place of unresolved trauma. And instead of trying to resolve that in a healthy way, you externalize your problems and you project these issues onto others in order to make yourself sort of feel immediately safe and protect yourself from ego threats. Psychologically, I think that is what's going on. And so when you have whole communities that operate this way, essentially you have a sort of cycle of abuse that is embodied and perpetuated communally and generationally. And this is something that I think ultimately in the United States very much goes back to the history of slavery and how, you know, slave owners didn't want to face that they were doing something very evil. You know, and so you create all these stereotypes and monstrous notions of others and always project your fears outward.
So when we look at how the anti-abortionists played the long game and appear to have won, although, of course, the final decision is not by the Supreme Court, we should remind ourselves, what do you expect to happen in the coming years around transgender rights, around same-sex marriage laws that we should be looking out for, and any hopes or thoughts that you have on how those can be countered, nipped in the bud before they get to the place that abortion got?
I'm not sure that short of really moving to rebalance the court, which would obviously also take the elimination of the filibuster, I think. Well, we don't have the filibuster in place for the appointment of judges at this point, but nevertheless, I don't expect, you know, Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin to allow this to happen. But if we don't really move to rebalance the courts, I think we're in trouble for a very long time. I think there's a very real possibility that, you know, these other important precedents establishing a right to privacy will fall, and that opens the way to nationwide federal laws that are very, very illiberal. And that's the thing that they have kind of avoided saying out loud up to the present. Christian right and the Republican Party have talked a lot about states' rights. But when you look at what they do, they don't really seem to believe in local government if it doesn't do what they want it to do. So for example, when Charlotte, North Carolina passed a non-discrimination ordinance that protected trans people with respect to bathroom use, the Republican-controlled state legislature overturned it. And now we also already have Republican senators very openly talking about passing a national 6-week abortion ban. So I think a lot of people, myself included, for a long time assumed that at first in a blue state for some time we would be safe. But now I think that if things go badly for the Democrats in 2022, and especially 2024, if Republicans control the Congress, and, you know, both houses of Congress and the presidency in 2024, well, they've got some time to overturn some other precedents by then. I think they'll pass a nationwide 6-week abortion ban. And I think they could very well move to make gender-affirming healthcare for trans people illegal, not just for children, but also for adults. What can we do about it at this point? I mean, I think the Democratic base needs to get really loud about how this is absolutely unacceptable. And we need to start being able to say in polite society that this Supreme Court is illegitimate. I think a lot of us were complacent for a long time about this notion that, well, once the Supreme Court has established a right, everyone basically respects it and it won't be taken away. Well, now we're seeing that it will be. And that Republicans have been speaking in bad faith about devolving control of these things to the states, at least in some cases, I think they will move to pass very illiberal federal laws.
Well, Chrissy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the article that you wrote that I referenced earlier. Best of luck to you, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Chrissy Stroup, ex-evangelical writer, speaker, and advocate, co-editor with Lauren O'Neill of the essay anthology Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. She's also senior correspondent for Religion Dispatches. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.